Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And Warren Buffett says his key to longevity is a diet loaded with sugar and product placements, and has a surgeon lost his mind with promises of viable human head transplants. Joining us to take on these and other medical ethical issues is bioethicist Art Kaplan. Art is the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the terrific Everyday Ethics podcast. Hey there, Art.
How are you?
Great.
We're great. Always love to talk to you, Art Kaplan. So let's start with this possibility of a $90,000 doctor shortage in the United States by 2025, just as everybody's getting older and older and needs doctors more and more. Is this a big deal? And if it is, what should we be doing about it?
It is a big deal, and it's something that, oddly, if Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, doesn't get overturned by the Supreme Court, is going to get worse, I think, sooner. And that's because more people will have access to doctors, and that means more people looking for primary care doctors, not specialists, not cardiologists, not endocrinologists, but family medicine, internal medicine, primary care people. And we don't have enough of those, and we're going to have even fewer of those in the years to come. So it's great if we, for example, enfranchise people and say, you have insurance, but if they can't find a doctor, or if we all get into longer lines waiting to see that primary care person, I should ask either of you, how long does it take you to get an appointment to see your primary care doc?
Well, Jim probably gets there instantaneously.
I have one on retainer, so it's not an issue.
On retainer. I don't think mine is that popular. It doesn't take me that long. But
So a lot of people might be told 2 months, 3 months, you know, you sort of have a backache or migraines, you don't want to hear that they'll see you in 3 months.
Right.
But you know, Art, there are many things I don't understand about this. Is one, why aren't there more seats in medical schools? I mean, I was a lawyer in my earlier life, and I think most honest lawyers would say there are far too many law schools.
Yeah.
I would say, as a layperson, there are far too few medical schools. Am I right?
Well, there's some new ones opening up. Probably the first burst of new medical schools we've seen in the U.S. has been occurring over the past 10 years, so maybe a dozen new medical schools have opened. Part of the problem with medical schools is you can only take so many folks in your lecture hall. You got to have your anatomy classes. It's pretty labor intensive. So it's not like you're going to expand the classes that exist. You're probably going to have to add new medical schools. And I think that process has begun, and that's good. But I'll tell you what, I think the answer to this shortage is something else. And now all physicians listening to this, don't drive off the road. But I think we've got to extend more authority to nurses, physician assistants, dentists, even pharmacists to do more primary care things like get vaccinations, take blood pressures.
But Art, one of the other things, you know, just because my kids are in the right age group, my oldest kid knows several people that are in medical school, the costs are unbelievable. You're in there for a long time, and then you get out, and you're not making very much money for a very long time. That's got to have a lot to do with this as well.
Well, further reason for Art's solution, nurses and
but I mean, to enable
physicians'
people,
assistants.
It's hard to when you come out of medical school, $200,000 in debt. You know what I mean?
Yes, I do, and that's why the specialties are so attractive. You come out loaded with debt. You think, boy, I can make triple, quadruple the amount of money if I'm in a specialty as a primary care thing. Something else is going on. There's a lot of folks who are now two-couple doctor people, more women in medical school. So those folks don't necessarily want to live in a rural community. They don't want to live out in rural western Massachusetts. Maybe there's not even a job for both of them at the same time. So we get geographic disparity because couples can't necessarily land two jobs, or maybe you aren't even willing to do two jobs in, let's say, rural areas. So again, we've got telemedicine. We could shoot images around, and you could see it in states like Alaska, where they've been doing that for a while due to the distances, where nurses look at things and then send images and maybe even interview the patient and send that in to a doctor in a bigger place. And I think, again, we're underutilizing our ancillary workforce, and I don't mean to be demeaning about that or anything, but the non-physician workforce, you know, they can manage your diabetes, they can yell at you to lose weight. There's a lot of things that they could do, and I think we should use them more and give them a little more authority to do these things. Otherwise, I don't think we're going to fill this gap.
You know, one, Yeah. Sorry, Art. One last thing on this telemedicine thing. Every time I respond to someone like you on an issue like this, I feel Unabomber-esque. I'm not anti-technology, but I worry when we talk about online courses at colleges, tele-doctors or whatever you do, telemedicine, that it's a great idea in the short run if it complements what is. But don't you worry that this becomes the replacement doctor or nurse or healthcare practitioner for low-income people, meaning people like us who don't have long waits, upper middle income people get to the doctors or the nurses or the whomever, low income people have to talk to their doctors or nurses on a computer.
Well, I think a lot more of us are going to be talking on a computer because that's also a better way to harangue us in between doctor visits so that, you know, people can wear a Fitbit and get yelled at by the doc and saying, you know, gee, Art, you really haven't moved in 72 hours. It might be a good idea to take a little walk there. So I think more of us are going to do it. I think also, remember, some of this is sending information. It isn't just interviewing and so forth. You know, there's your radiology, your head exam. It doesn't matter where that's looked at as long as it's looked at by somebody who's competent. So no, I'm not really freaked out about it in the same way. I've seen these programs that do psychiatric care using software, and that bothers me a little. I don't think that's, you know, kind of a solution to mental health. But for a lot of this, yeah, I think there's a future.
You know, Art, as you know, the trial of the younger Tsarnaev brother started yesterday in Boston. We're reading a lot of details, that some of which we knew parts of, some of which we knew nothing about. We talked about a little bit earlier in the show. One of the things that's been talked a lot about today is the fact that awaiting trial, Jahar Tsarnaev has been in solitary confinement for 23 hours a day. And we know that ethicists like you have been involved in debates for years about whether or not the death penalty is cruel and unusual punishment violative of the Constitution. Is there any debate in your community, the ethics community, about whether or not solitary confinement in a room with he's allowed one letter a week, all these kind of things. And this is not a sympathetic, for those ready to send an email, it's not showing sympathy for Tsarnaev. But is there an ethical debate about that issue, about the extended periods of solitary?
There is. And, you know, one of the first prisons, Eastern State Penitentiary in Philadelphia, built by the Quakers, well-intentioned to try and reform prison, what they did was they set up a prison where everybody was in solitary and they had a Bible. And that was it. You could step outside, I think, 1 hour a day in a little pen outside your cell. That prison's still there. And what we saw way back then was people went crazy. So it really is a problem. It's not that anybody has to be sympathetic toward murderers and killers and bombers, but if you want them, in a sense, to appreciate their punishment, you can't drive them insane. And if you want to put them on trial, you can't have them become insane. So I think constant solitary is probably inhumane, just as we know, you know, you're going to lose your mind if you have no stimulus, no human interaction, no nothing.
Yeah, I don't even get the purpose of it. I mean, I suppose if you're using it as a punishment kind of thing, but when you have these extended periods, I don't get it. If you want to separate someone from the general populace because they're a danger to themselves or others, again, that's one thing. But I don't still understand why you need to be confined for 23 hours in a prison cell.
Other countries have taken it off the boards for anybody under 18, by the way.
Really?
Yeah. Well, it's just too awful. But again, I'm not trying to say anything's too awful for people who are horrible. What I'm trying to say is you're going to make them crazy. That you just get demented after a time, and so then you just have a huge population of crazy people to deal with. We can see this at places like Pelican Bay out in California, where I think is an entire solitary prison, much like that old one in Philly. I don't think that's the way to be going. If you want to punish people, to put it this way, you almost have to maintain them mentally enough so they can appreciate they're being punished. What's
Wonderful
the point,
point
otherwise?
Great point.
We're talking with our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan. Art, there was a great story about these physicians that put together these questions that people can ask to determine whether someone is depressed or addicted to drugs or this kind of thing that could help people determine this.
Right, their question is like, are you addicted to drugs? But yes.
Well, I mean, a lot about what happened in your childhood. Things like before your 18th birthday, did a parent or adult in the household often swear at you, insult you, put you down, humiliate you, act in a way that might make you afraid you might be physically hurt? Or before your 18th birthday, did anyone at least 5 years older than you fondle you, touch you in a sexual way, attempt to have sex with these kinds of things? And the point is to determine, you know, depression, addiction, heart disease, that you have a predilection for those kinds of things because of childhood traumas and drugs, et cetera. But the physicians, this list was put together, and what's the deal? Physicians are afraid to ask the questions?
Yeah, they don't like to go there. It's embarrassing. They don't know what to say. They don't know how to follow up. So it isn't just teaching them the questions. It's teaching them the steps. What do you do next if you see it? You know, it's funny. We're very comfortable with genetic testing, right? If there was a gene for a predilection to addiction, we, and there probably is, we'll be testing for it. But in terms of the psychosocial experience or what happened to you as a child or were you ever abused, everybody gets all nervous about this sort of thing. So it seems to me both types of predictive information ought to be part of medical examinations, good primary care, to come back to what we were talking about. But the trick is to teach people what to say next. You know, we see the same thing, Marjorie, when people are dying and we teach doctors how to address the topic of dying with them, but if they're not comfortable about how to answer patient questions about spirituality or emotion or religion or whatever, they won't do it.
You know, by the way, this is the acronym for this, if people have heard something about it, is ACE. It's Adverse Childhood Experiences. And you just talk, I actually moderated a couple of panels of the Mass Hospital Association meeting on Friday, and they were primarily about integration of behavioral treatment into primary care, which I know is a huge issue.
Yeah.
And one of the things, and everybody advocated it, one of the things that they said is most primary care physicians have no courses on this in medical school, are totally unprepared for this additional burden. So this gets back to your point. You asked this question, which may be predictive of something that you may suffer from in the future. You get an answer that's pretty intimate and painful. Are most doctors prepared to deal with the follow-up?
I don't think so. We don't train them. We don't have a lot of continuing education on this. Medical school curriculum is pretty crammed. Where I would see this coming is, you know, doctors do take courses to maintain their licenses. This is a good continuing education area. It's new, so a lot of people who've already been through medical school probably didn't get much training in this. And by the way, I might extend this, you know, in the spirit of what we were talking about earlier about extending some of the primary care duties. This sounds like something you'd want to train people, say, ministers and rabbis and priests and that crowd. You know, they could be asking these questions and then making an appropriate referral. So it's great to have doctors do it, and I want to see that happen. But I think more people could do it. Teachers could do it.
Yeah. Exactly. Or there could be, as you talked about before, transferring some of this medical stuff over to people that are trained, but they're not physicians. You know, I saw this Atul Gawande Frontline piece about dying a few weeks ago, and again, I was stunned that even some of these physicians and their whole specialty, this one physician's specialty was a type of cancer that was nearly always fatal, and she talked about, even though this is what she did from morning until night, dealt with this almost always fatal kind of cancer, that she had very great difficulties talking about it. And Gawande admitted that he would lie to patients about their ability to respond to a drug rather than deal with the fact that they were probably going to be dead in a few months. It was fascinating.
Yeah, and I think one problem there is when you're dealing with these deadly diseases that rarely can be turned around, you know, it's hard to keep going at it and going at it, and so you start to ignore things or deceive yourself to protect yourself, because nobody likes to bat, you know, almost zero in terms of saving patients. And we emphasize, you know, to doctors, disease is the enemy. If you don't defeat it, you failed. So I think part of this is that mindset of we got to shift from if someone's going to die of a disease that we can't cure, it's not a failure. It's just part of medicine that we have to sort of adapt to.
Can I get back to this ACE score for 30 more seconds? I mean, the critical, you know, primary care physicians not trained enough for this. You said maybe expand the breadth of people who ask the questions. But isn't the first question really, does this work as its proponents suggest? They say in the NPR story, it's not a crystal ball, but might hint at your vulnerability to disease and mental illness. The mental illness part, I obviously buy. Is it predictive of weight gain, drinking, high blood pressure, or is it not? It is?
I know that there's pretty good evidence that women who wind up as sex workers were abused as kids. I do know that correlation. So it's a question you might want to ask in order to prevent people from, you know, being led into prostitution, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. I don't know how well it works otherwise. I'm not sure, but I'll bet this. I'll bet, kind of sight unseen, that it's about as predictive as a lot of our genetic tests. That is to say, you know, they indicate risk factors, but they're not 100% there.
Understood.
Okay, Art Kaplan, our medical ethicist, apparently you are everywhere. I see you all the time on CNN. Apparently you're doing some writing for Forbes magazine as well. Mm. I see your byline on a story with this headline: doctor seeking to perform head transplant is out of his mind. So this was written by you. Who is this guy, and why is he out of his mind?
No, I apologize. I forgot the guy's name, but he's an Italian neuroscientist.
Yeah, Sergio Canavero.
There we go. And he gave a presentation at a meeting and said, I'm going to announce at the next big brain science meeting that I think it's possible to do a head transplant, meaning take a head from a body and put it on a new body. Some wise guy asked me, are you moving the body to the head or the head to the body? But I think what is being proposed here is the head to the body. You want to take people who are dying or wasting away, maybe even some form of some types of Parkinson's disease or something like that, or ALS where you're becoming paralyzed, and give them a new body. That, and he says, we're ready to go.
What are you saying? But you blow it away. But I mean, I don't have the medical training or ethics training you do. But isn't there evidence that head transplants work? Look at Renee Zellweger. Wouldn't you agree that it worked?
You're,
you know,
nasty.
One of the reasons. You know, I read your thing, and obviously, knowing the little I know, you make a compelling case. But a year or so ago, Marjorie and I interviewed Bowden Pomahawk. I assume him, who has done virtually all the face transplants. One of the most exciting half hours we've ever spent on radio. Wouldn't you have said 10 years ago or whenever, I don't know when the first one was, 15 years ago, a face transplant is not very likely? I know I'm not suggesting a face is the same as a whole head.
So this will make you really laugh.
Yeah.
15 years ago, I did say that.
Really?
Yes. I wrote and said I think it would be unethical to do a face transplant. And I said we haven't done enough animal work to make sure that it would work. By the way, that would be true for head body things. You need to do a lot more animals, and all animal rights people communicate to Marjorie immediately about head transplants in animals and how you don't like those. But you wouldn't want to do it until you've done them. And I said, look, you're going to pour all this immunosuppression into people, which you need to prevent rejection. And that's nasty drugs. We usually don't worry about them when your heart has stopped and you need a heart transplant. But for a face, you're going to wind up shortening everybody's life. So anyway, the head transplant thing is the same problem, but worse. Face transplants have been slow to move. We've got the other big surgeon here at NYU who does them, Eduardo Rodriguez. And, you know, he's had a patient who's I've met and done well post-face transplant, but he's chronically in rejection. He's always fearful that, you know, this thing is going to get rejected, and they're constantly tweaking his dose. Moving a head with all that tissue and a lot of skin, I don't think that would work. And I think the other problem is, if we know how to regenerate the spinal cord, which is key, then there wouldn't be so many paralyzed people battling around.
Right.
I don't care what this guy says. If he knows how to fuse a spinal cord and make it work properly, instead of doing body transplants, he should head to rehab units and fix people.
Yeah.
Art Kaplan, there's one thing I didn't understand about this head transplant thing. Who is it? What is the patient's condition that they present themselves in need of a head transplant?
Yeah, so imagine this, Marjorie. You are slowly wasting away due to ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease.
Right.
So you're losing your body. And then you say, well, here's a person who's dying. Sadly, they had a terrible accident, massive head injury. Maybe I could put my head on that
body. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
One other small reality, just for listeners fantasizing about, you know, cosmetic head transplants or something. I'm waiting, you know, to get some bodybuilder's body stuck to put my head on.
If you can get a second one, give me a call.
But if you put on somebody else's body, the problem then becomes, look, the chemistry is different, the nerve patterns are different. You're going to get all these signals sent into your brain that they never tried to process before, and I think you'd go nuts. I mean,
yeah.
I think it would just overwhelm your brain.
Yeah, I don't know. That all sounds like something like the Twilight Zone or something, one of those horror shows.
So Marjorie's going to withdrawing her application pending your approval.
Yeah, I'm withdrawing. So
one final thing, by the way, for other optimists. There are some people, remember our friend Ted Williams?
Yes.
So this is a version of that too, right? It's sort of defrost your head and stick it on something later. But I wouldn't spend the money here.
So one last thing, Art Kaplan, the story about Warren Buffett that, you know, he's 84 years old, you know, big financier, made billions and billions of dollars. Turns out he's eating Utz potato strings and chocolate chip ice cream for breakfast and drinking Coca-Cola all day long. He owns a big chunk of Coca-Cola. And, you know, people are saying, well, look at this. He's living to 84 and he's doing great. But I don't know. This doesn't do anything for me. Is this a big deal? I mean, what do we make of this? He's lucky, I would say.
Well, for one thing, I bet he has good medical care. But aside from that, I think, you know, I had a teacher when I was getting my philosophy PhD who smoked three packs of Camels
a day. Yep.
He lived to 90-something.
Yep.
I don't know. Remember, these risk factors about diet, smoking, exercise, they're risk factors. There are people who just have the best genes on Earth, and they can overwhelm these things. So I'm not surprised that there are a few folks who smoke all the time or drink Coca-Cola around the clock or, you know, maybe very lazy and so forth. They beat the odds. But the fact is there are odds, and that's what you're sort of playing against here. You want to try to beat the odds or you want to lower the odds?
By the way, before we leave the subject, we should just say a quarter of his daily caloric intake, he suggests, is from Coca-Cola. And as Marjorie said, he owns 9% of the stock in the company. Now, Art, before you go, Everyday Ethics Podcast, what's up this week?
So this week we were going to take a look at the issue, if you will, of what about genetic testing for things like mental retardation and Down syndrome. It's coming, and we're starting to be able to do it in moms with a blood test. So none of this fancy amniocentesis or invasive procedures. Maybe do it as early as 7 or 8 weeks. What's that going to do to thinking about disability?
Hey, let's add that to our list for next week.
It's a tough one.
We will
That's
check it out.
That's a really tough one.
Yes, it is. Hey, Art, it's great to speak to you as always. Thanks so much for your time.
Hey, my pleasure.
Art Kaplan is head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics Podcast. Up next, the fate of Obamacare. After 3 years, the Affordable Care Act makes another trip to the Supreme Court. Law professor Renee Landers joins us for that discussion next on 89.7 WGBH.